This is the second week in a row in which we've had a Pulitzer Prize winner speak to us. And here you'll correct for my provincialism, we're breaking the pattern, which Edgar Shannon may say never was a pattern, of sometimes looking north but not west in where we turn. We didn't do that with the president, I know, incumbent president, but we do have many speakers from Washington and New York. We have far fewer from Chicago. So I think we're especially pleased to continue our series on constitutionalism with a discussion on constitutionalism in the media. We're even more pleased that our speaker, Jack Fuller, comes to us as executive editor of the Chicago Tribune. He received his Bachelor of Science degree from Northwestern, his JD degree from Yale Law School in 1973. He served in the United States Army, including a year in Vietnam as correspondent for Pacific Stars and Stripes. From 1973 to 1975, he was a general assignments reporter for the Chicago Tribune. 1975, he joined the United States Department of Justice in Washington as special assistant to the Attorney General, who at that time, as all of you know, was Ed Levy, who has visited the Miller Center on several occasions. He's the author of four novels, Convergence, Fragments, both of which won major awards, Mass, and Our Father's Shadow. He was the recipient of the American Bar Association Gavel Award, and in 1986 he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing. He lives in Evanston, Illinois, but not on Orrington Avenue, where I used to live. It's a great privilege and pleasure to have Mr. Fuller with us. I should say that our scout for this program, who had wide professional experience in looking in this area, was Robin Kuzin, who was sitting at the machine, who for 13 years administered the Pulitzer Prize. So we're grateful to her, and particularly grateful to Mr. Fuller for making the long trip to Charlottesville.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today to discuss one of my favorite subjects, the Constitution. And here in Jefferson territory, anyone in my position would be tempted to peel away with the usual journalists ringing statements about the virtues of freedom of the press. But I'm going to try to avoid that. Instead, I want to consider a different aspect of the relationship between the press and the law, to examine how well journalism delivers a civics lesson, that strange form of pedagogy that goes by the name of news. The place to begin, I suppose, is with the question whether public knowledge about the law really matters very much. At the most basic level, of course, the answer has to be that people have to know something about the rules in order for them to be able to abide by them. In some cases, we actually require people to take an exam, as we do before issuing someone a driver's license. I even recall having to pass a constitution test in order to graduate from junior high school, though I suspect that that requirement may have gone the way of the McGuffey reader. At the same time, we cannot expect people to know everything about the law, or we would be more a nation of lawyers than we already are. It must be clear to anyone but a hermit that he lives a life of any complexity, whether as a recipient of government entitlement checks or as a payer of capital gains tax, that at some point he's going to have an interlocutor with the legal order. This insight came to me in a humbling flash shortly after graduating from law school, when my father died, and for sentimental reasons, my mother asked me to handle the preparation of the estate tax returns. After weeks of research and consultation, I managed to complete the forms well enough that they did not embarrass my father's memory. It was a job that a competent legal secretary could have concluded in a matter of an hour. Perhaps we've allowed the legal order to become so complicated that we've developed an unhealthy dependency on lawyers. But for our purposes today, it is enough to acknowledge that it is virtually unimaginable that we could expect a person to master the details of all their legal requirements that impinge on him, the way we expect him to master the rules of the road before he gets behind the wheel of the car. I'm afraid I have to tell you that the press is not very useful in giving lessons in the law at either extreme. Because of its need to attract an audience every day by providing information of novelty and general interest, the press is neither suited to providing a continuing education about the meaning of octagonal street signs, nor to giving sound counsel on an insider's obligations under the regulations of the Securities and Exchange Commission. When we touch upon either kind of subject in the press, it is ordinarily because something has gone wrong, and the reader's attention is bound to be drawn to the wreckage. But between the extremes, there is a range of information that for the good of the legal order, it is very important that the public understand. And for better or worse, the press is the primary bearer of the message. I'm talking about the basic principles of constitutional justice upon which people build their belief that their system is worthy of confidence and respect or not worthy. Back in 1975, I left the newspaper business to go to Washington to work as a lawyer on the staff of Attorney General Levy. In what was then known as the post-Watergate era, one had the sense that even though the constitutional mechanisms had responded adequately, even remarkably, to malfeasance, the basic public trust in impartiality and fairness of the administration of justice had been severely shaken in the process. The Department of Justice, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the foreign intelligence agencies, Even the presidency all had shown themselves capable of manipulation, and this had soured the relationship between the public and the legal order. Perhaps, in retrospect, it does not now seem that the situation was as critical as it seemed then. But at the time, something very, very important seemed on the verge of being lost. And at the Department of Justice, as we reflected on this state of affairs, we recognized the urgency of the simple truth that without public confidence, the legal system cannot do its work. Nobody knows better than a law enforcement official that laws ultimately can never be enforced. They must be acceded to by a majority, a vast majority of people whose behavior is subject to them, or they will fail. We cannot and would not want to construct a judicial system big enough, a police apparatus pervasive enough, or jails expansive enough to frighten the public into lying. Punishment has an important role to play as an object lesson, a reinforcement of the basic urge to conform to legitimate rules. But if there were no belief in legitimacy, no internalization of the rules, punishment would have to veer into tyranny in order to gain any kind of adherence. It is for this fundamental reason, then, that the message about the law must get out and be accepted. In effect, the message is the law. And the peculiarity of the press as a messenger is that by its nature, reflecting the interests of the audience, it is drawn to crisis and conflict. We have just been through a bicentennial of the Constitution. When Kenneth Thompson first asked me to come here, he suggested I might want to talk about what effect the celebration of this anniversary has had upon public understanding of the document. As I thought about what shape such a talk might take, I realized that its principal appeal would be its brevity. The question of the bicentennial's effect could be answered in a sentence fragment, not very much at all. Far more significant in the public's education about the Constitution have been such less than uplifting events as the Watergate crisis, the continuing controversy over abortion, the meaning of racial equality, the spectacle of the confirmation hearings of Robert Bork. On a more routine level, people learn about the Constitution every time the Supreme Court hands down a ruling that gets press attention, and every time Congress and the President get into a fracas over who can do what to whom. So one underlying message the press delivers about the law is that of conflict, and this is altogether appropriate. The Constitution is a hardy document, and it grows stronger with exercise. If it were self-executing, if there were no strong disagreements about the meaning of its terms, then we wouldn't have to concern ourselves so much about the public's understanding of it. Another message to be drawn from these highly charged disputes is that the Constitution gets in the way of government. For some people, at some times, this is unsettling. Criminal defendants go free when there seems little genuine doubt about their guilt, or even more disturbing, concern by the constitutional tribunal for whether they are guilty or innocent. Progressive legislation to control campaign financing runs afoul of the First Amendment. State legislatures cannot put restrictions on abortion or require a simple non-denominational prayer at the beginning of the public school day. Of course, not everyone finds each of these impediments to government activity troubling. There are winners and losers in every constitutional contest. And when the Supreme Court officiates, it does not do so by reference to the latest public opinion poll. That is the point. The Constitution gives the majoritarian institutions of the Congress and the President vast power, but it also says that even an overwhelming majority cannot always have its way. The discomfort caused by this apparent violation of the democratic ideal is healthy. It means that a fairly accurate message about the meaning of limited government is getting out. But what about the press's meddlesome attention to claims that something has gone wrong, its fascination with real and imagined crises, and its eagerness to worry about every flaw? Don't these habits demoralize the populace and breed public cynicism? I'd be the last to suggest that we don't overdo our skepticism at times. In fact, it seems that in my role as executive editor, my job is to rein in our skepticism, or the skepticism of our reporters, repeatedly. And it's hard to love a common scold, but I must tell you that the most sophisticated leaders in the press are beginning to recognize that unless we learn something about civility and demonstrate that we're capable of steady, mature judgment, we'll be the victims of the very skepticism we sow, and the public confidence in us will continue to drop. And yet a critical and independent press is fully consistent with the ideal of constitutional government. In fact, if you permit me to succumb to the temptation just once, Thomas Jefferson was right to assert that an open constitutional order cannot exist without it. So if we communicate the sense that we're an irritant to government, that message is at least an accurate depiction of our role in the system of self-governance. This is not to say that we in the press don't pose risks. One risk that has a special place in this discussion involves our habit of caricature, our penchant for reducing a complex phenomenon to a few simple lines that, when repeated often enough, become a cliché. It is probably inevitable that the mass media, dealing with such a wide range of disciplines that it is impossible to gain expertise in them all, and operating under severe time and space constraints, will fall prey to oversimplification. This is a kind of entropy against which we have to struggle continuously. But I would argue that our ability to overcome it is what marks excellent journalism from mediocrity. When it comes to reporting the news about the Constitution, the greatest temptation is to reduce the discussion to terms suitable for ordinary political debate. Who wins and who loses? Who has the votes? Who is liberal and who is conservative? I don't think there are many tendencies more subversive of the constitutional ideal than the idea that there is nothing more to constitutional interpretation, or the interpretation of statutes for that matter, than the shifting personal preferences of the interpreters on the bench. And yet how often, particularly during the last few years, have we read articles analyzing members and nominees of the nation's highest court in terms that are best deployed to describe a candidate for Congress, or commentaries on difficult decisions that go no deeper into them than to note a shift to the left or to the right. On one level, this amounts to simple inaccuracy. To suggest, for example, that the justices of the Supreme Court, in the recent case challenging the constitutionality of the special prosecutor statute, cared primarily about whether Oliver North would be successfully tried is just plain silly. And any analysis of the jurisprudence of Antonin Scalia and Robert Bork that fails to recognize the differences between them is not revealing enough to bother with. The special prosecutor case involved the question of separation of powers, that if only because it had implication for other hybrid arrangements that have and will be attempted by Congress, had to be resolved on the basis of principles more general than the facts of the particular case. And having worked with Justice Scalia and Judge Bork when both were in the Department of Justice, I can tell you that their disagreements were far more energetic and deeply rooted than might be suggested by the fact that they both wear the label conservatives. The differences showed up, by the way, in a libel case when they were both on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. They sharply disagreed both on the outcome and the underlying legal analysis. Generally speaking, though, the press regarded Scalia's opinion as simply insensitive to First Amendment values and put down Bork's as an effort to win newspaper support for his nomination to the Supreme Court. Perhaps the press's reductionism in these kinds of matters is simply a reflection of the fact that the partisans around the edges of recent constitutional disputes have been, well, so very partisan. But I'm afraid that the press bears a good deal of responsibility for the current climate of opinion in which the law is seen as little more than another weapon in the arsenal of interests. That climate grows more inclement by the day. The press should be resisting it, and it should do so by trying to deal with constitutional disputes in the terms in which they are really debated and resolved. This means sharpening the distinction between political and jurisprudential argument, recognizing the institutional differences between courts, legislatures, and executive officials, paying attention to the technical nuances that often are decisive principles of decision that will have implication in future disputes. To the extent that the press is able to do this, it will not only fulfill its mission of reporting accurately the news about the way things work, but will also send a true message about the meaning and means of the Constitution when public attention is focused and education about the fundamentals of our system is most likely to occur. Anything less than that is bad journalism, journalism that corrodes the common bond. Now, I've given to understand that you would much rather pepper me with nasty questions about actually, you know, I assume you don't all read my newspaper. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to come into an area where that is so. I'd be glad to discuss the Washington Post or the New York Times or any other subject.
Who would like to begin our discussion?
Yeah.
Yeah,
sure. Well, when I lived in Evanston 30-odd years ago, I also read the Chicago Tribune. Now I read the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I'm not sure which is worse, coming to a venue where people read yesterday's Tribune or only read 30 years ago.
I think it was in the Journal. Had a rather interesting article not long ago on the subject of how a lot of cases are being argued not on the basis of what a law says, but on legislative intent. And attorneys are going back and going, it's a federal law, saying what were the hearings, what did that bring out? And also suggesting that, okay, the judges really almost being forced to make law rather than interpret, I think was the burden of this article. Then it went on to contend that Congress or other legislative bodies seeing this and finding one more way to sort of escape responsibility, deliberately word the laws vaguely so they won't be caught. Can you comment on that, or is it a problem? Or?
Well, we begin to answer this way. Statutes, laws written by Congress, or any legislature, are bound to be ambiguous. They're inevitably ambiguous. In some cases, they're intentionally ambiguous. The Constitution is, it can be argued, that kind of document. But statutes, which are more are intended to be less durable, or at least potentially less durable, still are sometimes intentionally ambiguous. And even when they're not, they are, the human language being what it is. Also, fact situations being as profligate as they are. It's almost impossible for a legislature to have imagined all the potential situations with which a particular statute might have to deal. And so it's commonplace and has been throughout the law and is not, is by no means unique to this period, that courts find themselves thrown back on the history of the passage of a particular statute in order to try to divine what it was that it was supposed to mean, those words, those Delphic words were supposed to mean. Nonetheless, I do believe that there is some truth to the assertion that, number one, legislators are often tempted to ambiguity, knowing that they can avoid the responsibility for what they have wrought and to throw it on the court. And number two, that the courts and certain kinds of courts and certain kinds of judges gleefully take the bait and are quite happy to use the ambiguities to impose their own particular views of what the law ought to be. They're very complex questions. You have to look at every particular statute in order to know whether that was seems to be what was involved in a particular decision or not. And I'm not sure enough of my own of history. I'm not sure of my own sense of history to know whether this phenomenon, at least with respect to statutory construction, is new or coming into focus because we've become, at least in some ways, more and more concerned about what the role of courts ought to be. The Journal, of course, is very sure of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And so it has very few doubts about history or anything else.
That I think it's got a shadow, maybe an error, but I never did.
A slightly different approach, and this gets back to the Tibian. Not reading it currently, two things. First, has Tibian taken a position on the election coming up?
In Chicago?
Yes. And second, when the election is over, is it possible that things will settle down into a normal political pattern as common in Chicago's history, or is there going to be any way of having a unified city?
It's to hope that the situation returns to what is normal for Chicago is a modest hope. I think we did take a position. We endorsed Rich Daley and in the primary, which is all we're dealing with so far. The fact is that this has been a rather remarkable campaign in that until quite recently the racial appeals, which had become so commonplace in Chicago, had been kept to a real minimum. Both candidates, Eugene Sawyer and the incumbent and Rich Daley, had tried very hard and succeeded largely in muting all of that, which is not to say that the vote itself isn't going to break down into a racial way, but it's been rather encouraging that we got through most of the campaign without blatantly racist appeals. Now, in the closing days, not done as quite as well as we had done all the way along. Some of Sawyer's supporters got up and made inflammatory statements. And then Daley was accused of himself making a racial appeal, which you probably read about, which he was quoted as saying, or he was accused by a self-appointed group of watchdogs of saying that what the city needed was a white mayor. I listened to that tape a dozen times. I can't tell what he said, but that's not surprising because half the time I can't understand what Daley, you know, Daley is here and the English language is here. Yeah, there was a moment. There was a moment which was quite winsome, really, and you ought to know about it. They right in the middle of the campaign, the Richard J. Daley Library, public library, was opened down in Bridgeport, which is Daley's home too. And remarkably, it was remarkable to everybody, Sis Daley, who was the mayor's widow, and Rich Daley, and Sawyer all showed up and behaved themselves in an extraordinarily civil, decent fashion, dignified, with one exception. It wasn't uncivil or undignified. It was just Rich Daley being Rich Daley. He couldn't pronounce the word library. It was the Richard J. Daley Library. So I don't know whether he said white mayor, what mayor, white mayor, what the hell. I don't think he knew. The audience didn't know. We had our own reporters out there, who were just waiting for this sort of thing and didn't hear it. The audience didn't hear it, and no reporters heard it. I mean, they heard this talk and they heard this fumble, but they didn't think of it as being a racial opinion. So I don't know what to make of that. But even despite those small lapses, relatively small lapses, it's been a remarkably gentle campaign on racial, in the racial sense.
It hasn't been reported that way in the New York Times.
Well, no, I mean, well, that's true. That's true. They're just wrong. They don't remember what it was like when Harold Washington ran the last time or the first time. They didn't take my phone calls when we endorsed Harold Washington. And when we endorsed Rich Daley, we didn't get an outpouring of black anger at all, the way we had gotten the outpouring of white anger before. And the way we've gotten outpouring of black anger and other endorsements in more supercharged times. So I'm rather encouraged that depending on how things go, that if, no matter which person wins, Daley or Sawyer this time around, and who wins, as long as it's not Berdoliak, who is not going to win. I mean, God, unless there really is some malign force operating in our midst, that a good deal of the racial rhetoric will have gone out of the situation. And I mean, I think that our principal difficulty with Sawyer has been that he's not a strong enough person or politician to stand up against the city council people, and as a consequence, he's. And I think the reason we endorse Daley is that he is much stronger, and that's why a lot of the white politicians are less than ecstatic at the prospects that another Daley will become mayor, because you know they remember what the last Daley made him do. You know, they got quite used to doing what a Daley told them to. So, but I think if no matter which one wins, they both committed themselves to in a very public way to cooling off all of that racial business. And I think if they do, it will cool off. I mean, what happened during the time of the during the Washington administration was that both sides, the white side and the black side, saw it in their interest. I mean, it was, there was an element of race in it, but there was something much more fundamental than race going on, which was power, and both sides saw it in their interest to make racial appeals. As it turned out, Harold Washington was much the shrewder of the two because he knew that he would ultimately win if he did. And he was delighted. No one could have been more happy than Harold Washington to have Verdoliak and Ed Burke behaving the way they did. And I was at, just this last week, I was at a gathering in which Burke remarkably finally acknowledged that they had played it all wrong, that Washington had him, and he knew he had him, and that they had done exactly what he needed for them to do. So that itself tells you that the white power bloc, not the white power bloc, but the white power bloc in the city council is less likely to go that way again, as they know what will happen to them if they do. So I'm rather optimistic.
Other question? Yes. David Butler.
You spoke about the media as though it was just the print media. But in fact, in Britain at least, and I think in the United States, television has taken over from print as the main source of political information. Now, we know that the television editors depend on what is visually effective. I wonder if you could comment on how far this has constrained popular understanding of the courts, that they are getting their information now not from the headlines, but from the visuals.
That's an interesting and very complicated question. First of all, I refer to it as the press the reason I do is an affectation. I'd rather talk about the press than the media. I'm much more comfortable talking about the print side. I find it much easier to defend what we do. I also find it much easier to criticize what we do because I know what the constraints on us are and I know what the pressures are. I can't say that I do the same as so when I'm trying to talk about TV, and so it's quite easy to be glib and critical about something that I've never engaged in. TV does a worse job than we do in often dealing with constitutional matters, although TV is a very powerful and supple medium, and in the right hands and deployed in the proper way, it can do extraordinary things. I know of very few educational events more powerful and affirmative in the area of constitutionalism than Fred Friendly's series on the Constitution and the Delicate Balance, which really did send the message that the Constitution is discourse and debate and complexity and seriousness. But it is true that, you know, when the question is what conclusions will people draw from the latest Supreme Court decision, television is going to deliver a very terse, rather unexciting, except in the sense that it's able to whip up some excitement by overstating the case, depiction of that. And there are no actualities that they can use because they can't get into the courthouse in most cases, certainly not the Supreme Court. And I suppose that's a constraint too. I've been myself, and the Tribune has been in favor of opening up the appeals courts to television. Not so much because we think that will produce the millennium in which the reporting of the courts will be richer and fuller and everything else, but rather just because it seems anachronistic to say that the TV cameras can't go into a place which is so important in our public understanding of the government. I think that on the that one further aspect of this, I don't know how it is in Great Britain, although I sense it's the same from the times I've been there and the people I've talked to. And this, I apologize for the immodesty that this will seem to show when I say it, but though it is true that most people probably get most of their information about the world from TV, or more people get it from TV than get it from reading. The fact is, TV gets most of its knowledge about the world from the press. I sometimes wonder what would happen if we all just stopped for about a week producing. I mean, I think it would be terror in the newsrooms, of the TV newsrooms of the country. They wouldn't know what to do. They wouldn't know what was important. They wouldn't know how to state things. They would do the clips, but you'd be surprised how that cliche, how true that cliche is, that it's the print media that set the agenda, and that's simply the case. A few papers in particular, which is something that I think I began to recognize most clearly when I was on the other side in the government, that there are half a dozen newspapers in the country which are terribly significant, and the Times is the most, the New York Times, of course, is the most significant of them all, to my despair.
Victor Yonke and then Howard Cromwell.
Mr. Fuller, recently George Will wrote a column about the lamentable state of high school education in Chicago, and I believe it may apply to other large cities too. Would a paper like the Nacogdoches Chicago Journal be concerned that it could no longer reach out to enlighten, inform, and educate the vast majority of people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a great campaign for literacy, which is run by the foundation that's connected with the Tribune. It is both public-spirited and terribly self-interested. If we have an illiterate population or a population that doesn't read, then our future is not very strong. You know, we're very concerned about the educational environment in the city of Chicago. Just this year, we ran an enormous series of articles about the disrepair in the public schools, picking up from Bennett's comment that the Chicago's public schools were the worst in the country. I don't know if they were the worst. They're the worst in the country. They're bad enough. They're bad enough to deserve that title. I mean, even if there's no way to compare them. It's a deteriorated situation in a lot of different respects. In Chicago, one of the things that has happened is that there has been a continuous draw off of middle class kids, black and white, out of the public schools, so that the public schools are left with the most difficult to educate kids there are, kids from families which are don't prepare them well to go to school to begin with, kids who live in the midst of profound pathology, social pathologies, which make it very difficult for them to focus on education. The quality of the faculty of the Chicago Public Schools has deteriorated enormously. It's inadequate. The state funding for public education throughout Illinois is a disgrace. state funding for education. I think I've forgotten precisely the number, but it's something like 40, somewhere between 41st and 45th among states in its funding. And the administration of the public schools has become larded with failures who have been promoted. The parochial schools, which do a better job in, of educating in Chicago than the public schools. So I heard the figure the other day, and I wish I could get it precise, but I'm sure that I'm not precise, but I'll give you the gist of it. Educating half as many children, the parochial schools do it with something like a tenth or a twentieth the number of people in administration. Those are all, we have a miserable union situation in the public school. Teachers are not, on the other hand, the teachers are not, as teachers aren't generally, are not respected and admired. So it's not attractive as a career for bright young people. People burn out, the best leave, the worst stay. Not altogether true. We found lots of examples of that were very bright spots, but they were bright spots in a very, very gloomy sky. So yeah, we're worried about it terribly. It's hard to imagine even when you think of it in purely in terms of the economic environment of the city, it's hard to imagine reaching any kind of new level of achievement in Chicago or the metropolitan region with a workforce as dismally prepared as the people who are coming out of the Chicago public schools are prepared. And every businessman in the city will tell you that it's becoming increasingly difficult to find people to do vital jobs, the sort that we need to have done from the Chicago public school.
Howard and then Lauren.
I'd like to ask your judgment as to what you see as the pros and cons of having a constitutional convention to change your constitution. There's a lot of talk every time we have a controversial issue like abortion. And as I understand it, we're within two states of having it authorized, provided there's no time limit on those resolutions states pass. But in as much as I understand the Constitution, any change suggested by a convention would have to be ratified by the states. What are the reasons why people are so scared of having a constitutional convention?
Well, I I'm one of them who would just as soon not have one. Thank you. I don't see the Madisons and the Adamses and the Jeffersons around to forge some new document, some new. And it was really quite a remarkable moment that gave rise to that document, you know, a remarkable intellectual moment. And we're not there. I mean, I don't want to be tricky or mean-spirited to the people now in being and say that they're not of the mind or the quality that statesmanship of the people who drew that document. But it happened at a remarkable time, a time suffused with extraordinary optimism about what could be accomplished. The people who drew that document genuinely believed that they were creating something utterly new under the sun and that was remarkable, and it was an experiment of noble proportions. Whether they were right about that is a subject of great historical discussion. because it wasn't all as new as they said that they thought it was. Many of the ideas, of course, have been around and were products of the Enlightenment period and all that, but we don't live at such an optimistic moment today. I think the document works rather well, and therefore is an overhaul is unnecessary. The things that people dislike about it are the things that I have a fair amount of affection for. People dislike it because, as I said in a little talk, it tends to hobble the government in various ways at various levels. This is not an unworthy thing to do. They dislike it because it's anti-majoritarian in various ways, that it does not reflect the sentiment of the moment. That also was quite a worthy achievement, it seems to me. We could all find things that we would rather have embodied in it, I suppose, and we could find some things we'd rather have out of it. But all in all, when I consider the alternatives, I'm not as I'm not eager to embark on a very uncertain process to develop something which would have to be quite something in order to be better suited than this one. Better suited piece of paper than this one has been.
Martin Henry.
Before, I wonder if you could comment from the perspective of civic education and city trust and so on, on the relationship between the Justice Department, and perhaps especially the Attorney General, and the presidency. You know, we seem increasingly, and not just in the last administration, to have attorneys general who are close political associates of the president, and the Department of Justice takes on a kind of a hard edge of advocacy of the president's immediate objectives. And there are other occasions of which perhaps the Levy term was a good example, when the Attorney General was not all that close to the president. Justice Department seems to be kind of the custodian of longer range political and constitutional values. How do you see the stakes in this kind of alternation and swing? Is there any, is it worthwhile or possible to think of a public education by which we might ask for a different kind of Justice Department and Attorney General than we seem to get most of the time?
Well, even the best Attorney General in the world under those circumstances, with the largest spirit, the public spirit in the world, would have difficulty overcoming the inherent skepticism that introduces. On the other hand, I certainly don't like to contemplate a Justice Department run by someone who is independent of the executive branch. I don't like special prosecutors for that reason. They can be unguided missiles. My experience in the Justice Department and after is that it's hard enough to control prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, when they are responsible politically to the Justice Department and to the President of the administration, let alone unshackling them and letting them do what as they will. And so, you know, you're trying to find a person who will be able to find a very delicate balance between responsibility to an administration and to the public, politically, with responsibility to the rule of law. Independent judgment. And that's always difficult. It was difficult. I mean, the temptations and pressures on both sides of that balance are enormous. It's very tempting on the one hand to the White House and the executive branch will naturally wants an attorney general to do its bidding and to perform and to give the kind of advice it wants to get about things, whether something is constitutional, for example. On the other hand, there's a great temptation to be a kind of a prig, you know, and say never. I mean, we're independent. The heck with you, President. The heck with you, White House. The heck with you, everyone. We know the law, and this is what it is. And that's not quite appropriate either. So it's very difficult. And a person who doesn't come into the job with a kind of confidence to begin with in his or her own professional judgments, jurisprudential judgments, and who doesn't come into the job unencumbered by expectations about cynical expectations about their political ambitions or their political alliances and all that, we'll find it very difficult to strike that balance. And so I agree with you that it's better for presidents to find better attorneys general than some of them have lately. I don't know of any institutional way to create a process in which that's going to be inevitable. I think that the kind of curve you described, the swing back and forth between one paradigm and the other, you know, the independent Justice Department and the slavish one, you know, that's probably the best you can hope for. All you can do is sort of maybe try to moderate the swings a bit. When it gets bad enough, people get upset. They don't like what they see. They react. They rebel. It becomes a political issue. Presidents have to adapt to that, and the next time they can turn around, they have to find a way to reassure folks, which is, I think, what happened this time in appointing Thornburgh. And then they forget. And we all forget, and the next time around, we don't know, you know, the next time around it becomes easier to appoint somebody who, you know, it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that a president might like someone who is intensely loyal to him as attorney general. It's a very threatening position. This is a person who prosecutes people. And that doesn't go unnoticed. Can prosecute people within the executive branch. It controls access to the Supreme Court. It shapes the whole constitutional underpinning of a presidential's policy, a president's policy. So the temptation is great, and presidents will succumb to it, and then we'll get upset when they go too far, and then they'll, next time around will be better, which is about what we get, I think.
Questions? Yes, Bill Harperley.
Given the furor over the Rushdie book, does not the sort of editorial part, the timing of the release of this book in view of the tense situation that's in the Middle East, the release of this book, isn't there some editorial sort of supervision that should be involved? It almost seems tantamount to shouting fire in a crowded theater with the way the turbulence in the Middle East, and to release a book at this time seemed rather poor timing. What's your judgment on this?
Well, first of all, if one were to wait for a time in the Middle East that wasn't turbulent in order to publish something controversial, one would go into the next, God knows when we would have any literature dealing with it. Second of all, I don't believe it's a compelling... Second of all, I don't know that anyone foresaw or would have been able to foresee the remarkable uproar that's occurred over this particular book. the book is impenetrable. The parts I've read the parts that are said to have been so inflammatory, and I found them soporific, not inflammatory. But of course, I'm not of the faith, but still, even trying to divine what it is about this book that is so inflammatory is difficult for me. I don't think anybody had assumed that it would set off this kind of a furor. Thirdly, I think that there is something quite useful. There's a useful lesson in this whole business, which we in the United States tend to forget, which is that literature is as an incitement. It is. Literature is subversive. Literature is an assault. Literature is scary. It's dangerous. It's easy to forget that here because, happily, we live in a society which has really, to a remarkable degree, learned to internalize the ideals of tolerance that you find in the Constitution. We are willing to tolerate an enormous diversity of literature. We're willing to tolerate extraordinary acts of literary assault because we recognize, for whatever reason, we become indoctrinated with the idea that a society is best governed when, or is best, operates best when it tolerates that, when it allows that kind of openness. But you shouldn't be deceived. Not the whole world. The whole world doesn't feel that sense of tolerance. The whole world doesn't sublimate its rage when it reads something that is an assault on its senses. Literature is dangerous. And that's all right, I think. I think, I don't know that even if Viking Penguin had known it would set off a burst of rage, it should have declined to publish that book. If that were the standard for declining to publish works of art, works of persuasion, many of the works that sustain us and invigorate us would never have been published. I'm not trying to make the argument that the Satanic Verses is going to go down as a masterpiece. I don't know. Doesn't seem like that to me, but nonetheless, you know, I mean, you think back to other works that have inflamed people. The great works of Irish literature, it seems like all the greatest plays in Irish literature touched off riots in the Abbey Theatre. In fact, a riot in the Abbey Theatre came to be sort of the critical acceptance in a way of Irish playwrights for a time. I mean, you know, these are things which, if they're the literature, when it in certain times and certain places is an extraordinary event, and this reminds us of that.
Of course,
people die for it.
In this case, some of the furor comes from people who haven't read it. It's not an intellectual challenge to anybody. It's just simply a symbol of opposition to their beliefs, and so they've gone off.
What I'm struck by, appalled by, is the initial response of the booksellers, the major booksellers. I mean, well, I just tell you, I mean, I'm in the business of publishing things. And the thought of not publishing, not selling, not putting out there something because somebody has gotten into livid rage about it and threatened me or threatened my institution is horrifying. We came back, I mean, this is not just us, not just the Chicago Tribune, but when Khomeini threatened Rushdie and Walden Books and B. Dalton and Barnes & Noble pulled the book off their shelves, our response was to print an editorial saying that if the Ayatollah's people lay a hand on Rushdie, somebody ought to kill the Ayatollah. I don't know if that's a good thing to say, a bad thing to say. We can debate about it. But that's the response. Something like that has got to be the response. Then we published Rushdie. The only way to deal with something like this is to be resolute. How can the booksellers wrap themselves in the First Amendment protection the next time around when the stakes aren't high, when they have abandoned the ideal when the stakes seemed a little high? I mean, I don't know how you, in some ways, it's almost as if we've become flaccid because of the protection we have under the First Amendment. We can be very bold against threats from our own government because we have a sense that the Constitution will protect us ultimately, or at least will moderate what the government can do. This instance reminds us that the First Amendment writ doesn't extend worldwide, and that there may be threats that come from elsewhere than our own government to free expression. And then the question is, how does that part of our society which is involved in free expression respond to that threat? To me, the only thing you can possibly do, the only way to respond, is to defy the threat. Absolutely, openly defy it.
The next questioner, in fairness, you ought to know, was chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago.
When I grew up in Chicago, which was a little before I went to the University of Chicago, the Tribune was 2 cents a copy, and reputedly editorial decisions were all made by Colonel McCormick, and they simmered down to the editorial page writers and to Kerry Orr and McCutcheon on the front page cartoons. Colonel's long gone from the tower. But I'm interested to know how editorial decisions are made with respect to such things as the balanced budget amendment, equal rights amendment, as well as political decisions about whether you go for daily or starting.
You're talking about editorial page decisions now, I take it. You're talking about endorsements, the taking of a position on a particular policy. Before I became executive editor and became neutral, I have no views now.
We can see that.
I'm Olympian in my... before I became executive editor, I was editorial page editor, and I can tell you how it worked and still does work. We have a group of writers and editors, and the cartoonists actually are joining this group, the editorial board. That group meets every day, every workday, in the morning and decides what we ought to be writing about, what we ought to be taking a position on, and what position we ought to take. The editor of the newspaper is a member of that group. The publisher of the newspaper, and the who is the chief executive officer of the parent company, and the president of the Chicago Tribune, occasionally will come down and chat with the editorial board, but more likely the editor of the newspaper and the editorial page editor. We generally talk to them before we make a political endorsement in a major race, president, mayor, governor. In my experience, there has never been a great dispute over those matters. The position of the Tribune, generally, what we stand for, generally, is comfortable all the way up and down the line. The editorial board itself is a very diverse group, politically and socially, racially, everything, generally. But everyone in the board understands that it is not, we're not, we, I speak, we, I'm not a member anymore, but that they're not there to vote their own personal preferences about the way an issue should come out, but to decide what this separate institution with its own separate history and tradition and voice ought to say about a given, and its own remarkable position within its community ought to say about something. And so there's a debate every morning. Some, the worst days are when there is no debate, when everybody thinks they know exactly what to say. It tends to be kind of lifeless, and the resulting editorial can be kind of flat. We're not cursed with that problem often. There's a lot of debate and discussion, and ultimately, and no vote. Generally, a consensus develops about what we should do. The consensus is possible because, as I say, people recognize, everyone recognizes fundamentally what we've been, what we stand for, and where we are in the community, and so there's not a great divide. All over some, you won't be surprised that over, that it's impossible to square the circle with respect to abortion, the death penalty, various, that sort of thing, those kinds of issues, any more than it is possible to square the circle in the society as a whole. But out of the consensus, which is really you could define it as a way of trying to find a position that is both forceful and comfortable to as many people as possible on the board. A position is established, and then someone writes it. And the position is just the editorial position is not hammered out in any complete way in the meeting. There's a debate and then kind of a resolution. Yeah, we ought to support that piece of legislation, or we ought to oppose it. That court decision was a bad one or was a good one. Then somebody who is, generally speaking, it's somebody who has worked in the field for some time as a writer, will go off and write something. That will then go to the editorial page editor, who will edit it both for the usual stylistic things and also, and for the argument, the rhetoric of it, but also to make sure that it accords as well as you can with the tenor of the discussion that we had. And then it goes in the newspaper. Sometimes the editor will be curious about a particular piece and will look at that one. Sometimes, I guess, the publisher might even take a look in advance, but that's rare. It's basically a decision delegated to the editorial board. And if we went far afield, you'd lose your job. I mean, it's just, I mean, I won't be naive about this. The reason it is that this group has gained the confidence of the people who are running the company, and they are comfortable with the basic thrust of the newspaper that's been developed over a period of years, and they're confident that the people will not go half-cocked in some way, and that they can, even if they don't know how that group will come out on every particular that comes along, they know that roughly the way, the thrust of it, which is what's really important in establishing the character of the newspaper anyway.
Bill, could your question be very short, or could you ask it privately of our guests? I think we've extended beyond our...
Yes, no, quite often. Privately or not at all.
By all means, privately.
No, it's not a very exciting one, you see. It's about lawyers.
Well, why don't we finish with the lawyer question then?
I just want to ask whether you think the press in its editorial pages should try to encourage and promote simplification of the law. There are a group of lawyers in New York who actually believe in that, but there are so few, and when you compare the beauty of the drafting and writing of the original Constitution with a lot of the statutory stuff that comes out of Congress, particularly in its staffs, it's their staff. It isn't the congressmen who write it. It is just horrendous.
I'm all in favor of simplicity. This nicely circles around to the very first question, because with simplicity you also get ambiguity. And the more terse you are, the more questions that are, the more things that are left open-ended. So it's, once again, not easy to state it as an either-or matter. There's certainly things that can be done much more simply. There are other things that shouldn't be, and that are perhaps too simply stated in the law as it exists today.
I think when we hear some of us who make presentations, we are a little inclined to say, better hurry up next week. He may not do quite so well. At 42, our speaker, Mr. Fuller, can look forward to a continuation of a very fruitful and rich career. And one can only speculate with this kind of tour de force today what 25 years from now that career might lead to. It's an honor for the Miller Center, but it also is the beginning of something even more exciting, I suspect, with the ability shown here. So we thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Oh.